This is the time set for oral argument in Begomania versus RDH, and I think all of you are familiar that we have now, you have the first 2 minutes to yourself without any interruption from the court, 17 minutes aside, and I was told by the clerk that respondents plan to divide their argument among themselves. Is that correct?
That is correct. You were splitting it equally, I think.
Okay. That's up to you guys to manage that time. Thank you. You may approach.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Corey Corbridge for the appellants. The district court dismissed plaintiff's complaint against these design professionals for one reason. It found that because there were two plaintiffs, their attorney, who they both shared, was required to file two separate affidavits of merit along with the complaint. That two affidavit requirement is not supported by the text of NRS 11.258, and it makes no sense when you consider the purpose of that statute either, which is to ensure that claims have some merit without creating technical procedural barriers that keep plaintiffs out of court. But that's exactly what the district court did here. It misused and misapplied dicta from the OTAC Nevada case to create a technical procedural barrier and kick these plaintiffs' claims out of court. We've also raised, there are serious issues with how and when the defendants raised these arguments. All three defendants filed an answer in the district court, and one of the defendants even moved for summary judgment before seeking any release based on this supposedly insufficient attorney affidavit. We think there's a very simple rule for cases like this. If a complaint is accompanied by an affidavit and an expert report, a defendant waives any challenge under NRS 11.258 by filing an answer. That rule strikes a balance between ensuring that claims do have some merit and preventing procedural gamesmanship. So let me start with the plain meaning of NRS 11.259. That statute says that the attorney for the complainant shall file. So the statute puts the burden of filing the affidavit on the attorney, not each complainant. And the district court's misinterpretation of the statute is clear from the order of dismissal when it repeatedly says that each complainant shall file. That's not what the statute requires. The statute requires the attorney to file. And so the question here is, did the attorney for Somerset Property file an affidavit of merit along with the complaint? The answer is yes. Did the attorney for Begomania file an affidavit of merit along with the complaint? Again, the answer is yes. It just so happens in this case that Michael Maupin represented both plaintiffs, so he filed one affidavit of merit. The two affidavit of merit requirement doesn't make sense when you consider what actually is supposed to go in the affidavit itself. The first requirement for the affidavit is that the attorney attests that he has reviewed the facts of the case, the whole case. The last requirement is the attorney has concluded that there's a reasonable basis in law and fact for the action, the whole case, the whole action. And we know from the City Center case that action means pleading. So the defendants will say that within that affidavit, the attorney was supposed to talk about the relationship of the parties and the different claims, but that's not what the statute requires. It requires a reasonable basis for the action. So if I, as the attorney, attest that there's a reasonable basis for the action, I'm necessarily attesting that all of the claims in the complaint have a reasonable basis in law and fact. And that's exactly what Michael Maupin did in this case.
So Mr. Maupin, as I understand it, from the filing of this complaint, he filed it on behalf of both plaintiffs.
Correct.
And what's the relationship between the two plaintiffs?
Right. They are. So you've got Somerset Property is the owner of the property, okay. And Begomania is the operator, the tenant who operates the restaurant on the property. So, okay. And it's important to note here that they're claiming the same defects by the defendants. So we're not talking about different conduct on the defendant's part that would have required some differentiation. We're talking about, if you look at these expert affidavits, they lay out in detail, along with the complaint itself, they lay out in detail what the plaintiffs allege these defendants did wrong.
So what in NRS 11.258 or 259 would indicate that there's some waiver that would apply here if it's not in their first responsive pleading.
Right. Well,
and actually, they did have an affirmative defense in their first responsive
right,
well, pleading.
First of all, it was listed as an affirmative defense, but it's not an affirmative defense.
Okay, so it's just a defense, not an affirmative defense.
Right, and so this court actually issued an opinion in the COSAR case, this panel did just a couple months ago, and it found that the affidavit requirement is not a jurisdictional requirement. So it can be waived. So the question then is, if it can be waived, when does it have to be raised? And the only principled basis I can think of is before an answer is filed. Because if you do anything else, so let's take a step back and consider the context of this. This court has ruled that a plaintiff who fails to comply with the affidavit requirement, and if there's a timely motion to dismiss, the complaint becomes void ab initio. That's a very harsh penalty. But when the court set out that penalty in Washoe Medical Center for medical malpractice, the court said, well, you know, this might have harsh consequences, but it cuts with a sharp but clean edge. That's what the court said. And so,
I mean, isn't it just like any other defense that you would raise in a motion to dismiss, or you can raise in a motion for judgment on the pleadings? Like, what's the distinction?
No, it's not, because it's rife for gamesmanship because of the void ab initio rule. So imagine a scenario where the defendant sees what they think is a technical defect. The plaintiff filed this complaint, thought it was sufficient, the attorney affidavit and reports were sufficient, but the defendant says, no, there's some problem with this. Okay, so defendant says, I could raise it right now, but if I do, the plaintiff's just gonna go fix it. And now we're off to the races with the case. But what I can do is I'm gonna wait and see what happens with the case. I'm gonna wait and see, maybe
so
I can
litigate and conduct discovery, and that will help them later?
Well, no, because if there's no timing requirement to make this motion, then you could get through discovery and say, okay, we're going to lose this case. Let's pull this out of our back pocket. This complaint was void ab initio the whole time.
Is there any case law saying that that's the case for the medical malpractice affidavit requirement?
There is not. No.
Has that been addressed at all?
I don't believe it has. So, but that's the problem, is it's got to be raised at some point. And so if you let them do it, essentially the alternatives you have in this case that have been proposed are either it needs to be raised before the answer, or it can be raised at any time.
I mean, if it's legally void ab initio and it's raised at some later time, then a legally void complaint can't become not void, or how would that work?
It can, because you get, well, you may also
assuming draw, it didn't comply with the statute.
Right, exactly. It's assuming that, but you can also draw a distinction between when a complaint is filed with an affidavit. So sometimes there's no affidavit at all. Maybe that's a different scenario. Whereas here, where you have an affidavit that's filed with the complaint and it appears to comply with all the requirements.
Was this affidavit filed on behalf of both plaintiffs?
Yes. So
how do we know that?
Because it complies with NRS 11.258. You've got it's what I was addressing earlier with attesting to the review of the facts of the case and attesting to review that there's a reasonable basis in the action. So in the Zohar case, it's a medical malpractice case. The court has said this in a lot of your cases, but you read the declaration or the affidavit along with the complaint. And so if you look at this complaint, it's filed on behalf of both plaintiffs. It alleges relationships between both plaintiffs and the defendants, and it alleges all the necessary elements of, for example, a breach of contract claim. So what you have required by this affidavit is an attorney who says, yes, I reviewed the facts of the case. I spoke with an expert. This was the right kind of expert to speak with. And based on my discussions with the expert, based on the reports that are attached to this affidavit, I conclude that there's a reasonable basis in fact and law for this action.
So actually, many of the paragraphs in Mr. Maupin's affidavit talk about what the Siegel Group has done rather than what he did. How does that comply with the statute?
Right. I want to start by saying not even the district court bid on that argument. And that's
okay.
Because
the argument was made, right?
Right.
Okay.
But
right.
The reason is because you have Michael Maupin, who is signing the affidavit. Michael Maupin signs the complaint. Michael Maupin is the addressee of both expert reports.
He is.
So I mean, if we're way into the land of procedural gamesmanship if we're talking about whether the Siegel Group filed this or Michael Maupin filed this.
So you're saying it did comply with the statute?
Absolutely.
So when he says the Siegel Group has consulted with Southwest Consulting, the Siegel Group, as in its capacity as counsel for the plaintiffs, reasonably believe the experts are knowledgeable.
In its capacity as counsel. So what you have, the defendants really argued was the Siegel Group's a real estate group. They're not lawyers.
Yeah.
But Michael Maupin is a lawyer. He's attesting that the Siegel Group is counsel in this case. It's in-house counsel for these two organizations.
So is there was there a legal department as part
That's
of
what,
Siegel
he's,
Group?
He's in-house counsel for the Siegel Group, who is affiliated with both of these plaintiffs. The plaintiffs are affiliated themselves.
Right. He says, I am an attorney with the Siegel Group and the counsel of record in the present action. That's what he says in the right. first paragraph of the right. declaration.
And so what I'm saying is there's clear case law that you interpret the complaint along with the affidavit, along with the expert reports. And it would be absurd to say that because he said the Siegel Group consulted, when you have two expert reports that are addressed to Michael Maupin, and then you have Michael Maupin signing the complaint.
I don't know what my colleagues think, but why don't you briefly address the jury demand issue?
Sorry, say that again?
The jury demand issue. Am I confusing cases?
You may be.
Yes,
or
I am. Sorry, my bad. I apologize. Two arguments today. Sorry, didn't mean to confuse you.
While we're on a break, I neglected to ask you how much time you wanted to reserve.
I'm going to try for 5 minutes, but I do want to make one point about OTAC Nevada before I sit down. We're not really, the district court and the defendants aren't really interpreting the statute here. They're interpreting one sentence from OTAC Nevada. And so in OTAC Nevada, the main holding is that the void ab initio rule from the medical malpractice context applies to this context too. The opinion could have ended there. Then there's a secondary holding that says each party that files a separate complaint has to file an attorney affidavit. And that's important in that case that it said each party that files a separate complaint, because one of the groups of parties was actually four defendants. I think they're referred to as P&R in the opinion. And so it's important that the court didn't just say each party must file a separate affidavit. It's each party that files a separate complaint. And so we complied with even that secondary holding here because there's only one complaint. And again, when you read that in conjunction with what the statute actually requires, it doesn't make any sense for there to be two affidavits. And so we're really talking about this rationale for a secondary holding that says, the reason for each party that files a separate complaint having to submit a separate attorney affidavit is because there's different relationships between the parties. But if you look at NRS 11.258, nowhere in there is it saying that part of the affidavit has to be an attestation to the relationship between the parties. You do that in the complaint itself through your allegations. And the complaint is read together with the affidavit. So with that, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Nick Wizorek. I represent Turpin and Rattan in this case. NRS 11.258 has served an important gatekeeping function here since 2007 when it was passed. And for those of you who were practicing at the time, you may recall that it was a legislative response to what was considered a explosion of construction defect litigation in the late 90s, early 2000s. In those contexts, many design professionals in Southern Nevada found themselves being sued for the first time in their careers after decades of practice. And they were leveraged to settle cases where they felt they had no legal responsibility. So the legislature spoke and came up with 11.258. As counsel indicated, I think it's important to look at the text of this statute. Counterparts such as California's California Civil Procedure 11.258 contain specific provisions about how many reports need to be filed. So in that statute, in Section C, it says that when a certificate is required, only one certificate shall be filed, notwithstanding that multiple defendants have been named. Now, the California version of the Certificate of Merit is different in how it executes things. Here, the Nevada version, we believe, was legislatively intentionally made rather toothy because it requires not only an attorney affidavit, but reports. And the presumption is that reports evidence the expert's review of the case from the standpoint of the litigant. So a textual look at this is important. 11.258.1D says that the certificate is required in the action. 11.258.1 says that the certificate requirement is specific to the complainant, and 11.257 identifies the complainant as the person who files the lawsuit.
But here we have two plaintiffs,
correct,
alleging the exact same facts, and their interests are aligned as landlord-tenant. I just don't understand the perfunctory nature of having to file two identical reports and two identical affidavits and just switching out the name of the plaintiff. I mean, they have the same attorney. The attorney did file an affidavit on behalf of his clients. Is this just form over function? How is your client prejudiced? I mean, just...
Well, I don't believe it's form over function, Justice, because the goal, of course, by filing a report or writing a report, the goal is for the expert to identify the issues pertinent to the claimant, the person who files the lawsuit. Somerset and Bagel Mania have slightly different positions in this case. Somerset is the owner, so-called owner. Bagel Mania is a tenant, and rights of tenants do not coalesce with rights of owners and their own.
Are you expecting an architect expert to offer a legal opinion about their rights to make a claim?
Certainly not. But if, for example, if you look at the mechanical engineer's report, which was attached to the affidavit, mm-hmm, basically says, well, the mechanical design was lousy. That's fine. That can be his opinion, but his opinion can be expressed as to both claimants in the case, because there are two plaintiffs in one lawsuit.
He's describing a defect in the defendant's work. And what would be the point of having him differentiate between two plaintiffs who are asserting the same defect, albeit maybe their injuries are slightly different or their damage claims might be slightly different, but he's not opining about their damage claims. So why would we write a statute that requires that?
Well, as I said, other state counterparts are specific about saying you only need to file one report. Nevada's did not.
But is there any policy reason that you can see for requiring multiple affidavits when the plaintiffs vis-a-vis the injury asserted are identically situated?
The policy would be that it would assure that both the attorney and the expert have looked at the case from the standpoint of each party, which if you...
How does that affect the defendant?
It affects the defendants in terms of how they respond to the claims in the case. This case never got far enough for the defendants to figure out Somerset versus Bagel Mania's individual interests. It got cut off in the early stages. We don't know what Bagel Mania is.
Isn't the purpose of the affidavit requirement to assure that an expert examined the wrong alleged and determined that there was a basis for it in the discipline that the claim is
correct,
arising out of?
You are absolutely correct. But again, this is what the statute says here in Nevada. And if you look at the OTAC opinion, the language in OTAC was not dicta. This court said that each party that files a separate complaint for non-residential construction malpractice must file its own expert report.
Okay, nobody filed a separate complaint.
There's one complaint here. It's one unified complaint alleging the exact same defects, which were reviewed by experts who presumably whose positions are not going to change based on the position of the plaintiffs in this instance, because they're aligned, right? It's the tenant. The damages may be different. That's a different issue. But whether or not the defect exists in his mind and whether or not there's a merit to the complaint, I mean, look, I understand what you're saying in terms of the gatekeeping function of the statute, but I don't think the legislator intended to preclude legitimate claims against design professionals or to prevent access to the court.
Well, this is a textual discussion. So again, we have to look to what the statute says and how this court has previously interpreted it. And again, the key language from OTAC was that the certificate and the claims must be justified based on that party's relationship to the defendant. Mm-hmm. I understand there's one complaint. I understand there's two individual standalone plaintiffs. It would not be a heavy lift for counsel to do a second certificate saying, I've looked at this from the standpoint of Somerset. My experts have looked at this from the standpoint of Bagel Mania.
Here's how would that make any difference in the contents?
Because it's not a guarantee that they would be the same. We do not know that at this point, because the default was to, let's just file one affidavit and throw it all in there. So there very well may be a factual reason why, if you look at this from the standpoint of the lessee, look at this from the standpoint of the owner, there could be differences. We don't know that, though, because...
How would that create a difference in what is being certified here? Like, this attorney, Mr. Maupin, filed the complaint on behalf of both plaintiffs.
Correct.
And, you know, even without the statute under Rule 11, he's certifying, it's got a reasonable basis in fact and law on behalf of all the clients he represents, right?
Certainly.
And now, and this affidavit adds to that this statute adds to that by saying he's got to have consulted with an expert pertinent to the field who's qualified in the field. And thus, and after doing that, there's a reasonable basis in fact and law.
Understood. The onus is not the attorney files the affidavit. The statute contemplates the content of the affidavit. What has to be in it? Well, it's two parties in this case. That's the distinction, not the one attorney filing it.
So the affidavit has to say he's reviewed the facts of the case, he's consulted with an expert, he reasonably believes the expert is knowledgeable in the relevant discipline, and he's concluded based on the review and consultation that the action has a reasonable basis in law and fact. How would the affidavit be any different?
Because the discipline is different for a mechanical engineer versus an architect versus a...
He had both, right?
There were three reports attached to a singular affidavit, which did not make the distinguishing discussion. That's the difference, at least from our angle. Let me please defer to Mr. Yeah. Winland so he can speak to some of the other issues unique to this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Morning, Your Honors. John Welland for RDH Interests. May it please the court. Just very quickly, I'd like to touch upon the statute itself, 11258. I believe, Justice, you brought up a very good point. There is a very serious question as to who consulted with this expert. Under Mr. Maupin's affidavit, he starts with the word I. I read the complaint. I am an attorney. I reviewed the facts of the complaint. All of a sudden, paragraph 3 of the affidavit switches to the Siegel Group. And I think that distinction is critically important. In the Reef v. Barker-Drotter case, that's a case that I brought before this court, the court expressly stated the attorney for the complaint has to also be the attorney that consulted with the expert. We don't have that here. We have... Mm-hmm. Mr. Maupin saying somebody at Siegel Group. And if you say, well, he was the attorney of record, I'll represent to you the affidavit has another attorney on it. And I'm going to butcher her name. I apologize. Amanda Radafanan, I believe, is also on it. We don't know. We
on
don't
the
know.
Affidavit?
On the affidavit at the caption, if you look at the first page, caption at the very top left corner, there's at least two attorneys. So we know there's at least two attorneys with, quote unquote, the Siegel Group. We don't know which of those two or if either one of those two consulted with an expert. So there's a secondary failure, Your Honor. It's failure to comply with the black letter law of the statute under 11.
Do you think this requires strict compliance or is there substantial compliance? Okay, because you can make the inference that Mr. Maupin is the one that consulted with the experts.
Justice, it has to be strict. Because if it's not strict, then we're going to have a slippery slope. It's going to ultimately eviscerate 11258.
Did you argue in your briefing that substantial compliance is not sufficient?
I did not, Your Honor, nor did they.
Thank you.
To my knowledge. But I'm just bringing...
Why would it not be... Why can't you consult through a colleague in your firm?
We don't know that, though, Justice. With all due respect...
Well, he's with Siegel Group.
Correct.
And he says Siegel Group consulted, and he is an attorney with Siegel Group. I mean, lawyers as a group practice as a group, and they have others in their firm consult. So
like you can't talk to an expert and have your associate do the affidavit?
Right, but Your Honor, we don't have any of that information. That's the slippery slope of substantial compliance, right? Or Leo could have met him. It could have been the vice president.
What would be the purpose of that?
So that he can attest, and in this case he did not, he can attest that there's a reasonable basis in law and fact for the case to proceed. That is a certification to the court, Your Honor. Justice, sorry. It's a certification that he did all these steps. That's the fundamental bottom line of the affidavit. He didn't do it. He could have easily said, I met with the two experts. I determined that they have the necessary qualifications. I determined that based on my consultation that there's a reasonable basis in law and fact for this. He didn't do any of that. He just simply said the Siegel Group, Siegel Group, Siegel Group. And I get that you can consult. We don't know he did that. And I don't know why he didn't just simply say I if he's the one who did it. We don't know. And that's the fundamental failure in addition to the OTAC vote. Briefly, Your Honor, we also had fees in this. I don't believe that was even discussed. There's an entire history in this case. Multiple complaints, multiple dismissals. Judge Williams' patience was at the end.
If we vacated the court's, if we reversed the court's decision, then the fees would become moot at that point, correct?
That is true. That is correct, Your Honor. Justice, sorry. But I would ask this court to consider the history, and the history is important. Justice, Judge Williams did everything he could to help them. They didn't comply. They first didn't comply, then they got a contractor expert, then they try to redeem themselves by slipping in an architectural resume, and then they go and get another affidavit of merit, this time in violation of OTAC, and we contend in violation 11258. Now, counsel said it wasn't even discussed. I disagree. The record shows it was discussed extensively, both in pleadings and in oral arguments in the hearing, and I'll direct the court to the record. That's the basis of the fees. It's a sanctions fee. Judge Williams determined it was harassment, vexatious. The record speaks for itself. Briefly, Your Honor, there were two offers of judgment. I believe the primary basis of the fees was sanctions, but nevertheless, there was a secondary offer of judgment. Their main argument is the Betty factors and the Brunzell factors were not discussed. The record discusses both those factors. So we contend, Your Honor, that they didn't comply with 11258. And also that the fees awarded to my client should be upheld. With that, I will yield to Mr. Ramirez.
Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. Jorge Ramirez on behalf of GEM Associates West. I'm here to discuss the waiver argument that we saw in the briefs and then heard in the pleadings. There is nothing in NRS 11.259. that allows for waiver. It's not discussed at all. So what the appellant is asking for, they're asking for this court to legislate through judicial fiat. They want this court to add that provision into 11.259 when it doesn't exist. It wasn't even mentioned at all by the legislature when the action was enacted. So for them to now say that we waived it because we answered, and as has been pointed out, both in the briefs and in argument today, when we answered, we preserved our failure to state a claim defense. We preserved the defense so that if we found that there was a deficiency in the affidavit of merit later on, or in any action that
Isn't that something you could have ascertained contemporaneously with the submission of the affidavit of merit? It doesn't change. There's no amount of discovery that changes the affidavit of merit that was submitted.
There could be, Your Honor. So I'll give the court an example. Okay. If we go through discovery and later we find out that maybe the architectural expert never said anything about my client, which is a kitchen designer. If we find that out, well, then the complaint as to my client is void ab initio right at that moment.
But you have the expert report that's appended to the affidavit of merit, right? That would set forth which defects are being called out, and you can ascertain for yourself whether or not that was performed by your client or not.
Yes, we do. But again, just because he puts it in a report prior to the litigation, once he has to sit there and swear under oath to testify, that might change.
Do you think that the you guys could agree that you don't need an affidavit? Like, don't bother with it? It'll just add to the expense of the case?
No, I think that an affidavit is required. It's definitely required under
the
statute.
So you think that it couldn't be consensually dispensed with?
The affidavit of merit? My client, at least none of my clients would ever consensually dispense with that.
You may answer the question.
Okay. So, no, I guess, well, to answer the question, yes, you could consensually do that. But I don't think that any defense attorney in practice would do that because of the scenario that I just
understand that. I was just asking theoretically. Thank you.
Sorry. Yeah. Would it be okay? I have a question for Mr. Wieczorek that I forgot to raise, just specific to your client, sir, and I'm sorry I didn't catch it earlier, and I hope I'm on the right case this time.
Turpin
sorry about that. Yes. In any event, there was a partial summary judgment order that was entered for your client after the district court had already entered an order granting the motion to dismiss. So my question is, did the court still have jurisdiction over the case after dismissing the entire case to enter an order granting partial summary judgment?
I would think the dismissal would put the brakes on any further activity. So to the extent the order was entered or issued after the case was already dismissed, I'm not sure that would be enforceable nor something that we would fall back on in any potential future later stages.
Thank you. Thanks, Justice.
I want to start with Justice Lee's question. Is this form over function? 100% this is form over function. And they don't even have the form right. So if you look at the statute, what they're saying is required in these affidavits is not required in these affidavits. Justice Kittis, you had asked me, how do we know the affidavit is for both plaintiffs? Mm-hmm. If you look at the affidavit, it's page 777 and 778 of the record.
Yeah.
Paragraph 5 says the Siegel Group in its capacity as counsel for the plaintiffs, plural. The signature also lists Michael Maupin as the attorneys for plaintiffs, Bagel Mania Holdings, LLC, and Somerset Property, LLC. I also want to address whether Michael Maupin was the one who actually consulted with the experts. I believe he might have been on one of the site visits listed in the expert report,
yeah.
But the report's actually addressed to him, and it's attached to the complaint. So in my opinion, even if all he did in this case, which I don't think it's all he did, if all he did was look at that report and then attach it to his complaint, he's consulted with an expert. The Rafe decision, that's an unpublished decision from this court. I don't know if the court is familiar with the facts, but it was an out-of-state attorney who wasn't actually pro hoc vice in the case,
right,
signed the affidavit.
Right.
Totally different circumstance.
Could you address the attorney's fees issue just briefly in terms of was that a sanction or was it derivative of an offer of judgment?
I don't know because the court didn't say.
Okay.
So the order doesn't give any reason. It says that the plaintiff or the defendant was the prevailing party. And then it awards fees for an entire litigation history that included two other cases. So it can't be under the offer of judgment rule because you'd have to award fees incurred after the offer of judgment. And the court doesn't make any other findings that would support the award under any other rule or statute. So I don't know the answer to that. Nothing allows for waiver is what you just heard, but we know that it's not a jurisdictional requirement, so it has to be waivable. So it's not true that nothing allows for waiver. If you look at NRS 11.259 subsection 2, it contemplates that some of these cases are going to go forward even though the affidavit requirements haven't been met. It says that let me find the language.
It says the affidavit can be later filed.
It also says that the fact that an attorney complied or failed to comply is admissible in the action. That's subsection 2 of NRS 11.2592. So right there in the statute, the legislature is contemplating there are going to be cases to go forward. And I want to take a step back and think about the competing penalties here. The defendant argued, well, we might decide later in the case that this expert didn't actually say what he said in his report. That's not an issue with the pleading requirement, the affidavit requirement. That's an issue for summary judgment. The plaintiff can't actually meet the standard or can't produce a standard of care or a breach. So most of the arguments in their answering brief are way beyond what we talked about with the district court, what's in the record with the district court, and they're really arguments about the merits of these claims. And TRE did try to raise issues with the merits of the claims and the relationships between the parties, and the district court denied summary judgment on those basis. The complaint alleges that the plaintiffs are either contracted with these different defendants or third-party beneficiaries of contracts with these defendants. So the relationship is in the complaint itself.
I have one question for you. I mean, to me, the OTAC case borrows the void ab initio language from the Med-Mal context, but reading this statute, the wording of it is very, very different. And permitting an affidavit to be filed later is inconsistent with the void ab initio rubric, is it not?
Right, and I also think that's a harsh penalty. And it's not only a harsh penalty, but it creates absurd consequences when you have defendants who argue that they could decide later that the original affidavit actually was insufficient.
Well, our court did clarify in the published Reef case that it's just got to be done by the time of service rather than filing.
Right. Right, and there are Med-Mal cases that allow for that too, I think.
Yeah, and then the complaint truly isn't void ab initio. It's a claim for medical malpractice. There could be other claims joined with it.
Right, and that's so if you institute a rule that a defendant waives this argument by failing to move to dismiss, it's not the end of the case for them. They can later say there's not a sufficient expert and move for actual relief on the merits of the case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.